Look at your investment portfolio right now. Like, pull up your app. You probably think, you know, I own a tiny piece of a massive tech giant, or maybe a fraction of some global logistics firm.
Right, the standard retail investor mindset.
Exactly. And you just assume those companies take their extra cash, park it in safe index funds, maybe acquire a smaller competitor, or build a new warehouse. And, well, that's the end of the story.
Just dry administrative housekeeping.
Yeah. Completely dry. But what if I told you that the capital sitting on a modern corporation's balance sheet is it's actively being weaponized?
It really is. It's a completely different battlefield now.
So today we are taking a hard look at the hidden architecture of corporate capital. We're pulling from some incredibly dense, but honestly super revealing source material titled Strategic Paradigms of Corporate Investment and Vision 2030.
Yeah, it's a fascinating document.
And the mission for this deep dive is to decode what these massive capital allocations actually reveal about a company's survival strategy, you know, long after the PR spin fades.
So, okay, let's unpack this. To really understand the sheer scale of this paradigm shift, we have to look past the traditional corporate menu.
Right, like the basic stuff everyone knows.
Exactly. We all know the standard vehicles. You've got equity, debt instruments, M&A, real estate, R&D. But the most sophisticated corporations today, they're no longer utilizing these tools simply to diversify their financial risk.
They're not just trying to like hedge their bets against a bad quarter.
No, not at all. They are executing a much more aggressive strategy. They're diversifying their operational influence.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're engineering leverage across entirely new markets and, crucially, over public narratives.
So we are moving away from just parking cash to beat inflation or satisfy some quarterly earnings call.
Completely.
If the ultimate goal is to buy systemic influence rather than just hold, you know, static assets,
Yeah.
the mechanisms they use must look fundamentally different from traditional portfolio management, right?
They operate on a completely different rubric. Think of it as like a new trifecta for corporate capital.
A trifecta.
Right. A successful strategic investment today must execute three functions simultaneously. First, it must generate an independent profit. Second, it has to establish strategic control over a choke point.
A choke point.
Exactly. And third, it must future-proof the core business against structural shocks.
That concept of establishing strategic control over a choke point is fascinating to me. It's less like buying a ticket to a stadium so you can watch the game, and it's more like quietly purchasing the rights to the only toll road leading into the city.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. Like, you don't care who wins the game because you are monetizing the supply route itself.
Yeah, and the primary mechanism for setting up those toll roads, as you put it, is the strategic minority stake.
Okay, break that down for me.
So a corporation acquires anywhere from, say, 10 to 30% of an adjacent company. This secures a board seat and operational insight without the massive legal liability or, you know, the capital drain of an outright acquisition.
Oh, I see. Amazon's move with Rivian illustrates this perfectly, doesn't it?
It's a textbook example.
Because on the surface, a casual observer just sees a massive tech giant taking a speculative financial bet on the electric vehicle boom.
Right, like they're just buying into the hype.
Yeah, but looking at the actual mechanics, Amazon had zero interest in becoming a consumer auto dealer.
None whatsoever. They were neutralizing their own existential vulnerability.
Which is what? Delivery costs.
Exactly. Amazon's heaviest future liability was last-mile delivery logistics. So by injecting massive capital into Rivian in exchange for a significant minority stake, plus exclusive commercial vehicle contracts.
Oh, they locked in the supply.
Yes. They've effectively capped their future logistics costs. They ensured they get the vans first at preferred pricing while simultaneously starving their retail competitors of that exact same electric infrastructure.
Wow. So it is a vertical integration play, but executed really dynamically.
Nicely.
Which makes total sense when you consider the supply chain breakdowns we saw just a few years ago. The companies that own the raw materials and the transit networks were like the only ones insulated from those macroeconomic shocks.
They are the only ones still moving products.
Right. But I have to push back a little on how some of these quote-unquote investments are justified in a boardroom.
Okay, sure.
Because tangible assets like electric vans are one thing, but our source material highlights data infrastructure as a prime vehicle for strategic control.
Oh, absolutely. Data is massive.
But we're talking about a retail conglomerate spending tens of millions of dollars to build an internal proprietary AI forecasting tool.
Right.
That invisible ecosystem doesn't neatly liquidate on a balance sheet. So, how does a CEO justify that massive capital expenditure to, you know, institutional shareholders who are constantly demanding visible quarterly ROI?
Well, they do it by redefining the metric of success. It shifts from immediate liquidity to structural survival.
Structural survival.
Yeah. A proprietary data ecosystem creates a durable, almost impenetrable competitive moat. Think about it. If a retail chain's AI can predict a shift in regional consumer habits, say, 3 weeks before a competitor,
they can completely optimize their inventory.
Exactly. They optimize turnover and drastically reduce holding costs. Over a five-year horizon, that invisible data infrastructure mathematically eclipses any short-term dividend payout because it essentially guarantees market dominance.
So the ROI is basically the fact that your competitor goes bankrupt trying to keep up.
Basically, yeah.
That's ruthless.
Yeah.
But, okay, if building a bespoke AI tool is the defensive long game, we need to examine the offensive strategies. Because to maintain that dominance, the source shows companies are acquiring assets that seem, honestly, completely erratic.
Right, but the erratic nature is entirely deliberate.
Really?
Yeah. A core premise we keep seeing in modern capital allocation is that diversification isn't just about balancing a spreadsheet anymore. It's about establishing unpredictability.
Wait, unpredictability as a strategy?
Yes, because if a competitor can perfectly model your capital expenditure, they can flank you.
Oh, man. Let's analyze the mechanics of that unpredictability, starting with intellectual property. Because traditionally, a patent is a shield, right?
Yeah.
You invent a widget, you patent it, and you sue anyone who copies it.
That's the old way of thinking.
Right. But now we are seeing corporations use IP as an aggressive legal offense. They are deploying vast sums of capital to buy up patents for technologies they don't even currently produce.
It's wild. They are mapping out their competitors' five-year product roadmaps and then buying the foundational IP required to build those future products.
That's basically corporate sabotage.
It's strategic blocking. When the competitor finally pivots to that new technology, they suddenly realize they have to pay massive royalty fees to their biggest rival just to manufacture their own goods.
Wow, so it transforms a standard legal document into a recurring revenue stream.
Yeah.
And a blockade.
Exactly. And when they aren't buying external IP, they are funding in-house accelerators.
Oh, right, the internal VC thing.
Yeah. They act as venture capitalists for their own employees. They give seed money to top-tier engineering talent to develop startups within the corporate walls.
So it retains the talent who would otherwise, you know, just jump ship to Silicon Valley and start their own thing.
Right, and it ensures that if a disruptive innovation is going to destroy their core business model, well, they're the ones who own the disruption.
Own your own disruption. I love that.
It also serves a critical function in shaping narrative power,
yeah,
specifically regarding ESG, you know, environmental, social, and governance assets.
Okay, we need to strip away the PR around ESG for a second, because based on the source, this isn't about planting a tree for a press release.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
It is a strict prerequisite for accessing global capital markets.
Really? A prerequisite?
Yes. Institutional investors and sovereign wealth funds now utilize algorithmic ESG screens. If a corporation cannot verifiably prove they are investing in ethical supply chains or green energy infrastructure, they literally face higher borrowing costs on institutional debt.
Oh, wow. So it directly hits their bottom line.
Exactly. Putting capital into social housing or verifiable carbon offset networks lowers the corporation's weighted average cost of capital. It's a purely financial mechanism now.
That makes so much sense. Okay, but of all the unconventional mechanisms we are discussing, the one that fundamentally like breaks the traditional model for me is litigation finance.
Oh, yes. This is a fascinating space.
Corporations acting as banks to underwrite lawsuits. I mean, here is where it gets really interesting.
It is becoming a multi-billion dollar niche, particularly in the US and UK legal markets.
Let's break down the mechanics of how a non-legal corporation actually executes this. So they find a massive high-stakes lawsuit, maybe an antitrust case or a huge IP infringement suit.
Right, usually cases where the plaintiff lacks the capital to fight a war of attrition in court against a huge defendant.
Exactly. So the corporation steps in and provides non-recourse funding. They just cover all the legal fees. And if the case loses, the corporation writes it off as a loss. But if the case wins or settles,
they take 20, 30, or even 40% of a multi-million dollar judgment.
That is insane.
The strategic brilliance of this asset class, though, is its total lack of correlation to broader economic cycles.
Right. If the S&P 500 drops 20% tomorrow, or if global inflation spikes, it has absolutely zero impact on the verdict of an antitrust lawsuit in a federal court.
Exactly. It operates in a total vacuum.
It is wild to realize corporate treasuries are treating the judicial system like an alternative asset class. But, okay, with this vast, chaotic menu of options, you know, from underwriting lawsuits to weaponizing patents to building internal AI, the internal capital allocation meetings must be a total nightmare.
Oh, I'm sure they are.
How does the CFO evaluate a litigation finance deal against an internal AI tool?
Well, the source outlines a structural tension triad to evaluate every dollar spent. It's a scorecard balancing three competing metrics: control, return, and narrative power.
It's like an engineering constraint. Or actually, it's kind of like allocating skill points in a video game character. You cannot maximize all three stats simultaneously without breaking the whole build.
Precisely. You have to make trade-offs. Let's analyze how standard vehicles map to this triad. If a Treasury department buys a passive index fund, they secure moderate liquidity and stable returns, right?
Right.
But they possess zero operational control, and it yields absolutely zero narrative power. The market doesn't care. Now, consider an aggressive M&A strategy, like a massive leveraged buyout of a competitor.
Well, that maximizes control immediately.
It does. But it introduces immense debt, which heavily degrades the return metric over the short term. And if the buyout looks monopolistic, it can actively damage their narrative power and invite regulatory scrutiny.
Oh, I see.
Alternatively, pouring billions into R&D for quantum computing sacrifices, immediate return for long-term control. But it maximizes narrative power by signaling to the global market that they are architects of the future.
So the specific combination of metrics a company chooses to prioritize reveals their true geopolitical and market ambitions.
Exactly. And the final filter applied to that triad is the concept of future-proofing.
Which is where the text says most companies fail.
Right.
Yes. The vast majority of legacy corporations fail because they allocate capital based on what generated returns 5 years ago, rather than predicting the macroeconomic environment 5 years from now.
Yeah.
The distinction lies in understanding the secondary value of physical assets. Consider massive capital deployments into tourism infrastructure.
Okay.
Building a luxury resort network seems like a standard slow-growth real estate play. But the sophisticated capital sees those physical buildings simply as data collection nodes.
The physical asset is just the bait.
Exactly.
The actual revenue engine is the digital ecosystem wrapped around it.
Yeah.
The proprietary app that tracks how the consumer moves,
yeah,
what they purchase, their behavioral loops across the property.
Yeah.
You monetize the data, not just the hotel room.
Precisely. Another stark example from the text is green hydrogen.
Oh, yeah.
Allocating billions to green hydrogen infrastructure today appears highly speculative, but the objective isn't immediate profitability. The objective is to establish the underlying technical standards and patent portfolios that will anchor the global energy grid in a decade.
So you don't just want a market share. You are paying to become the market itself.
Exactly.
But forecasting a global energy transition 10 years out and, you know, committing billions to it carries an astronomical risk profile for an isolated, publicly traded company.
Oh, absolutely.
That kind of trend prediction seems almost impossible to underwrite unless you have a guarantee that the market will actually exist.
Right. It is impossible in a vacuum. But the risk calculus changes entirely when you aren't just predicting a trend, but actively forcing it into existence.
Forcing it.
Yes. Which brings us to the ultimate macro application of these strategies, which the text highlights as Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030.
This is where we see capital allocation on a geopolitical scale. Vision 2030 isn't just a national rebranding. It is a sovereign entity acting as the ultimate market maker.
They really are.
They are deploying capital with such massive gravity that it physically reroutes global supply chains towards specific industries like AI, biotechnology, and renewable energy.
The mechanics of how they exercise that influence are deeply mathematical. The primary lever is their sovereign wealth fund, the PIF.
Right.
When the PIF announces a multi-billion dollar mega project, they aren't just investing. They are providing guaranteed capital expenditure and initial offtake agreements.
They act as the anchor tenant for an entire nascent industry.
Precisely. If they want to build a domestic automation sector, they launch a massive smart city initiative that requires millions of autonomous units. This guaranteed demand drastically lowers the risk premium for secondary international investors.
Oh, because the buyer is already guaranteed.
Exactly. Global contractors are effectively forced to open regional headquarters and transfer technology just to access those contracts.
Wow.
Additionally, the PIF utilizes the same strategic minority stakes we discussed earlier. They acquire significant positions in global tech firms to quietly steer their R&D toward applications that benefit the kingdom's broader goals.
The second major lever mentioned in the text is the use of public-private partnerships, or PPPs. These structures blend the basically bottomless liquidity of the sovereign state with the hyper-specialized execution capabilities of private, often international corporations.
PPPs solve the capital expenditure problem. Building next-generation healthcare data infrastructure or advanced desalination plants requires upfront capital that a private corporation just cannot justify to its shareholders.
Right. The ROI takes way too long.
Exactly. So the state provides the capital and the regulatory stability, while the private entity provides the technological execution.
But wait, when you introduce that much state capital alongside foreign expertise, how do they prevent value extraction? Like, what stops massive foreign multinationals from coming in via foreign direct investment and simply hollowing out the local market? You know, just repatriating all the profits back to their home countries.
Well, that is exactly why Vision 2030 mandates a highly structured hybrid model. Pure, unrestricted foreign direct investment is actually rare. Instead, access is gated through joint ventures and localized co-branding.
Ah, I see. So the foreign capital provides the scale and the IP, but the domestic capital ensures operational control and retains a significant portion of the equity.
Exactly. It forces the foreign entity to integrate into the local ecosystem rather than just exploit it.
It's a symbiotic containment strategy.
Very well put. And because the structural positioning is so deliberate, capital is flowing heavily into specific engineered sectors.
Like what?
Well, logistics and warehousing are expanding rapidly to capitalize on the engineered trade routes. AI and automation are seeing massive inflows, not just for external consumer products, but for internal bureaucratic efficiency.
Right.
Education tech is bypassing traditional models to focus heavily on digital and vocational upskilling. Healthcare capital is flowing away from just building physical hospitals and toward predictive data systems and telemedicine.
And crucially, entertainment.
Yes, massive investments there.
Media rights, esports infrastructure, digital content creation, they are being treated as serious high-yield asset classes to diversify the economy away from just a singular reliance on petrochemicals.
It's a total structural pivot. But, you know, for decades, participating in these sovereign-backed, high-level infrastructure projects was completely walled off to anyone outside of massive institutional funds.
Yeah, regular investors couldn't touch that.
Exactly. But that barrier to entry is eroding through new financial technologies. The text highlights platforms like Osul Gamma, which are emerging specifically to bridge this gap.
Modernizing access.
Right, creating a modernized access point to the Saudi market.
By utilizing blockchain technology, they are tokenizing these massive real assets. So they are taking a multi-billion dollar logistics hub or a green energy grid and fracturing the equity into digital tokens.
It completely democratizes access. It allows a much broader range of capital to participate in these highly structured opportunities.
It merges the massive macroeconomic scale of Vision 2030 with the borderless agility of decentralized digital assets.
Exactly right.
So, synthesizing everything we have unpacked today, you know, from Amazon's chokehold on logistics to the weaponization of patent law, all the way to sovereign wealth funds engineering global energy markets, the overarching thesis is stark.
It really is.
The era of passive corporate housekeeping is dead.
Completely dead.
The capital currently dominating the market is aggressive, unpredictable, and entirely focused on structural control.
Yeah.
If a company is not actively shaping the market, they are simply waiting to be priced out of it.
You can no longer invest based on a 2015 paradigm. You have to operate as an architect of the ecosystem, not merely a participant within it.
Exactly.
And for you listening, this fundamentally changes how you should consume financial news. The next time a headline announces a boring M&A deal or a corporate venture into green hydrogen, you now have the decoder ring.
Yes, you can look past the PR spin.
Right. You can look at the balance sheet and determine if they are just chasing a temporary yield or if they are systematically buying up the infrastructure of their entire industry.
You can see if they are maximizing return at the expense of control or if they are sacrificing short-term profits to secure total narrative power. Stop investing like it's 2015. Start thinking like a builder, not just a buyer.
Exactly. Be a builder.
But I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to chew on. We discussed how tokenized real assets are allowing fractional ownership of massive infrastructure projects.
Right, the Osol Gamma example.
Yeah. If multinational corporations are moving toward owning tiny fractions of entirely new asset classes just to build their narrative power and strategic control, what happens when regular everyday people start pooling their own resources on the blockchain to buy strategic minority stakes in their own local municipal projects or neighborhood data networks?
Oh, wow. That's an interesting thought.
Right. If anyone anywhere can be a builder now who really holds the power of the narrative tomorrow,